teaching this year. It's my first time, and I understand that. Oh, man. Yeah. First time I heard it over there for Vespers, I thought, oh, you know, kind of different. And then by the second night, I thought, well, yeah, yeah, I'm beginning to see it, and I'm all with it now. Boy. Yeah.
So,
in any case, I thought that what I would do today is just very, very quickly go over what green and brown make blue, which is the title of my session today. I thought, however, that instead of talking largely about that material, I'll bring it in as we go through the next few minutes or so. But I thought then what I would do is turn to some conclusions and solutions. You know, we've been moving in that direction. For those of you who have been with me for a couple of days, I started sort of moving in that closure direction on Wednesday when we talked about the triangle, right, the earth, wind, and fire triangle. And yesterday we were actually moving in that direction too, because I've been asked probably more than any other question, well, what do we do? You know, what do we do to solve all these problems that we've been going over? And yesterday we found a very, very simple solution as to what it is we might do with respect to that particular problem. So today, again, conclusions and solutions with a little bit of paint by number, a little bit of color as well. I do plan on having this to be even more formal than it has been in the past. So again, if we have a little bit of extra time at the end, I would like to spend that time reflecting with you about the things that we have talked about for the past a week or so. Okay, so where to begin? I think where I want to begin is, again, with that question that I was asked a couple of days ago about why bother with this, all right? I continue to think about that question, and I still think, I'm still convinced that we ought to bother about this. In part, we ought to bother about the kinds of questions that we've been looking at, largely because we're here at Holden. And Holden is not just here, but it's also out there. And we carry with us, once exposed to certain kinds of ideas and thoughts, we carry with us a kind of obligation to do something with those ideas. Right? This is part of the idea that I have talked about on occasion, where I say our faith has to be aggressive. Our faith cannot be a passive kind of thing. I have a colleague, actually, at Augustana, who teaches in the English department, not Paul Olson, as it turns out. And my colleague describes himself, or I should put it this way, he did describe himself about, I guess it must be about 12 years ago, as a jihad Lutheran, right? So he doesn't describe himself that way anymore, because it's probably not politically correct. But he does still talk about himself as being a militant Lutheran. And he's a militant Lutheran because he takes his Lutheranism very, very seriously. Again, it's that aggressive faith that I hope I might have at least a little bit pushed in the direction of when I've raised the kinds of questions that I've raised over the past few weeks. So just to recap again some of those questions, since this is a kind of closure summary question and may come up again. We started off wondering about who it was that we were, okay? We looked at the notion of what it is to be us, and we found that it's a complicated story. However, most people today believe it's not complicated at all. We are biochemical systems, and once we figure out the biochemistry, all of our solutions will be laid out in front of us. We'll have a certain kind of certainty that comes with all sorts of descriptive and predictive and explanatory power. All right. So that's the majority view right now. Even many people who claim not to hold that view act as though that is the correct view. All right. So there's a little bit of dissonance there. There are others, however, those dualists, as I've talked about them, they say when it comes to thinking about us, there are two things to take into account, slightly more complex story, both the mind and the body. All right. And the mind is sort of more cognitive, the body is more emotional. All right. The two interact, although it's a mystery exactly how they interact, but we'll suppose that they do interact. And that's their story. But I think our story has to be even more complicated. I think that that dualist tradition goes a long way, but it does leave out that aggressive kind of faith. All right? It does leave out the spirit. spiritedness, the fire as I talked about it last time, that I think gives us a kind of holistic view of who it is that we are. That's the oldest view. It's also the least popular view. But that view goes way back. It goes way, way back, both in the Christian tradition and also in the Greek tradition. So that's a little bit about who we might be. We're going to talk about that some more today. I will end with a story. As many of you know, I like to mix facts and stories. And I'll end with actually a pretty darn personal story, but I think it'll highlight some of the ideas that I've been and that we've been talking about as we've gone through the week. A couple of other key ideas to pull in, two in particular. This notion of freedom, all right? In addition to the question, I want answers, which in some sense is the wrong question to ask, right? Because if one thing I've said is that you're not going to find those answers, we're merely human. Right? Humans can't come up with those definitive answers we'd all love to have. All right? But the second question that's been most common over the past week is, you know that freedom argument you put on the board? How do you get out of that? Now, I felt sort of bad yesterday because there was a woman who departed, and she was, elderly. She may have been in her late 60s. And she came up to me and she said, to wrestle with. and that notion of how I ought to live. Okay, how I ought to live, and then we'll end with the story. So here are the principles of deep living. The first principle of deep living is one that I think I've already mentioned, and that is the idea of stewardship. Right? If we're going to boil things down to the simplest level, then I think we need to take that notion of stewardship very, very seriously. Stewardship is the idea, one of the ideas, that Genesis holds very clearly in terms of our relationship to our world. All right? Not only to each other, but to our world. So today, as I was walking along, I saw snowshoe hair, and I saw Indian paintbrush, and I saw some birds that I couldn't identify, and I saw a number of other beautiful, beautiful things. And the idea is that in some sense they are just as intrinsically valuable as I am. All right? Now, this idea is not new with me, but it is an idea that we've forgotten. It is an idea that Augustine, among others, St. Augustine, among others, said was intuitive. It's something that we have by our very nature. This idea is the idea of a chain of being. Has anybody ever heard of the chain of being? I know that the pre-Socratics used this as well. Augustine got it out of the Jerusalem tradition, and the pre-Socratics got it out of the Athenian tradition. And again, if you were with me early on, you know that sometimes those two wrestle with each other, those two traditions. So what the chain of being says is that indeed, creation consists of all sorts of things. It's not just about us, all right? So creation has a kind of hierarchy, according to the chain of being, according to Augustine, St. Augustine. And it begins with God, all right? God sits at the very top, all right? What's next? If this is intuitive, if it's in our nature to kind of have a moral sense about these things, all right, what would be next on that chain of being? No. Who? Somebody said it? Angels. Angels. Angels, surely. What comes after that? Well, humans is a troubling word, though, remember. So, what part of humans?
Men.
So.
Men? That's good. I think that happened sort of with the Enlightenment, actually.
Yeah.
All right. So, I'll skip the thought I'm thinking right now. In any case, so we have God, we have angels, right? Our soul. It's of the same kind as the others, right? It's immaterial, as Descartes called it in his sort of naive, simplistic sort of way. After that, it is the human body. It's the human body. But that human body is alike or akin, as the materialists have recognized, if you think back to that discussion, it's the same kind of thing as animal bodies, right? But animal bodies don't have our fire. They don't have our wind. They don't have our mind. They don't have our spirit. But they do have bodies just like us. So going way back, thousands of years, we had God, sometimes called the supremely perfect being. We had angels, or lesser gods, if we go to the Athenian traditions and avoid the Jerusalem tradition. But they're consistent stories. There's that greater being. There's the angels. There's the fire, spirit, soul. Then we have the body. And then only after that, we have plants, and then we have inanimate things. So that scale of being, that creation story, is something that we have to care for. Notice we're not at the bottom. We do have a certain kind of, like I said, hierarchy that gives us responsibility, that makes some modern people say that those other things are moral patients of ours. We're moral agents, or we're just agents, right? We do things. We are responsible for what we do. If the one rock tumbles onto a beautiful Indian paintbrush, we don't hold that rock responsible, all right? But if I were to step on the very last specimen of Indian paintbrush, Barbara Collins would probably be very upset, right? And with good reason, because I ought to know better, right? So we have stewardship over that which is. And I think what we about, or at least much of what he's talked about. And many of the things that I've talked about when I shared all those dreadful environmental kinds of statistics with you over the past few days, right, that says something's gone wrong with our notion of stewardship. All right, so that's my first deep living principle. Here's my second one. These are all interconnected. Frugality. Again, John DeGraff talked about affluenza. Our overconsumptive habits. I've talked about that as well. All right? We cannot live in a consumerist culture and at the same time be stewards of our world, of our being. I mean, those two do not mix. All right? So we have to move towards simplicity, towards less consumption. And I think that one of the important things that we have to remember when we talk about this is that frugality and stewardship, too, requires certain kinds of policy changes. In particular, and these are great, what we have to do is we have to think about changing policies in economics, as we've already seen throughout the week, policies in our social structure and political structure, and our technological orientation. All right? So when we say we have to live more simply, right, that again carries a certain kind of responsibility that we bear. And now, of course, we'll see that we can talk about that responsibility in neutral social political terms, or we can talk about it like that militant Lutheran friend of mine. All right? And those are two different conversations that one would have. All right? And we'll have at least part of one of those as we go on. All right. My third principle of deep living. This one is one that involves the quality of life. And again, when John DeGraff talked about this over the past few days, he says we got to move away from that notion of what's your standard of living, all right, to questions about the quality of life, all right? I think he's absolutely dead right with that. Two observations. One observation is from the person that I was going to talk about a bit more today and decided not to in light of all of your wonderful conversations that I've had over the past few days. That person's name is Ramachandran Guha, and he comes from India. And he is one of the leading scholars in deep ecology in India. And this was going to be my case study, he offers a critique of deep ecology as we think of it here in the United States. And his critique is very, very insightful. It's very provocative. And it's provocative for the following reason. He says this. He says, you know, deep ecology, as you hear about it, as it's promoted, is actually a uniquely Western affluent kind of phenomenon. All right? So he tells us stories about our moral, utilitarian, pragmatic traditions. He tells us stories about our wildernesses, all right, our rugged individualism. And he says, from his Indian perspective, all right, he says, you know, maybe we ought to reconsider some of that. All right, let's take, for example, that notion of a wilderness. And we could use Holden as an example here. His example is the Great Tetons and Yellowstone, right? The treasure, the national treasure. Says, who's going to those great wilderness and land preserved areas? Who's going there in the United States? People who can afford it. When they were first thought of by Roosevelt and others, right, the idea was you hop into your car and you take a family vacation. But that's not free, right? When you go, and I'm guilty of this, I was there last year with my family. When you go to Yellowstone, right, how many people do you see that don't look like you, right, that don't have the newest outdoor equipment, or that don't have their SUVs, right, that drive beat up old cars with, you know, retread tires that spew out exhaust, right, and have banged out duct-taped up windows, along with their duct-taped up shoes, you don't see them. Why not? Because they can't afford to get there, let alone be there once they get there. So Guha says, you know, America, This idea of your wilderness is great. It's just that it somehow, here's his terminology, is a balm that you wear to make you feel like you're reconnecting with nature. All right? Harsh, harsh words. But you know, he's got something. He's got an idea there. So what does he say? He says, in my country, I've seen your ideals as well, and they're not good. All right, so this is hard for us to take. Because after all, until I read him, I thought I was a deep ecologist. I thought that was the way to go. All right? Now I read him, and I knew there had to be something else, because that was not the way to go. So he gives us another example, Project Tiger. Project Tiger. Project Tiger is a nature preserve in India. I think it's about 5,000 acres, so it is huge. And it is an area that was set aside for various kinds of big cats that live natively in that area. And the project was funded by the World Wildlife Federation. Okay, you've all seen their little panda logos, WWF, World Wildlife Federation, or fund. And this project was thought to be a fantastic project. A lot of money was poured into it. The area was actually spruced up so that the tigers could thrive. The tigers did indeed thrive. All right. How are you going to maintain this thing, right, of that size? Well, what you do is you bring in wealthy European and American tourists, and then they can drive through this area, right, on safari and see the tigers that we've saved. All right. That's sort of problematic, he says, all right? Because again, think about all of the fuel that's consumed in order to get to the point where you can do that. But the other problem is that, first of all, native people from India cannot go there because it's very expensive, all right? And it's hard to get to. And secondly, those indigenous people that lived on those 5,000 acres, they were resettled. They had to leave. So his claim is, great idea to have these huge areas, but again, if you think of the costs, maybe deep ecology isn't the way to go. Very interesting. Very interesting. He has much, much more to say, but again, if you want to get to that, we can. I want to move on and get to my three quotations, because I do want to be sure to have time for those quotations and also for my story. So any initial comments, suggestions? Guha, right? For example, what are you thinking about Guha? Different spin on things. He's also the one who throws in lots of little statistics such as more than half of the world's women who are able-bodied, so not too young, not too old, who are able-bodied women, more than half of the world's women walk 5 to 8 miles a day doing what?
Getting water.
Right? Now, how many American women walk 5 to 8 miles a day to get water? And what happens if the women who do walk that far to get water don't get it? Think about all the people that are relying on them. All right? So again, a lot of interesting little facts like that he throws in as well. And he says, what we got to do is we got to move to a place where we're not thinking so much about standard of living. John DeGraff has clearly convinced us of that. Maybe, he says, we don't even need to think about quality of life as much as we think we need to think about it, and at that the deep ecologists shudder. But maybe what we need to think about, and again think yesterday, is sheer survival. All right? The women who are walking those 8 miles a day, 5 to 8 miles a day, aren't thinking quality of life, right? They're thinking sheer survival. In our own United States, the 1 out of 12 children who are malnourished, they're not thinking quality of life, right? They're thinking sheer survival. I talked about a person that I encountered when I was in graduate school, Hippolito Torres. Was anybody there for that class? Were you there? You might have. Okay, you were there. So Hippolito was a kid, a young teenager who was living in Toledo, Ohio, and regularly feeding his family via garbage can food. garbage bin food here in the United States not that long ago. And he wasn't the only one. And his life turned out bad, but somehow he recaptured it. All right, so what Guha is saying is maybe we need to look again at this. And we can worry about that once we figured out how to get one out of three human beings on this planet to the point where they don't have to worry about their survival. And that is the fact, one out of three. Okay, so let's move to the quotations. And this is, again, moving in the direction of solutions and conclusions. All right, things that we need to think about and act upon, perhaps. So here is terminology from last week. Pax Romana. Pax Romana is the Roman tradition. It's sort of like the Athenian tradition. It is the tradition out of which Cicero came, when Cicero said this: freedom is obedience to the law. So we wondered earlier about what freedom was. I mean, it's one of the characteristics that defines us above the animals, right, in that chain of being. But what exactly is freedom? Cicero says it's freedom is obedience to the law. Others say it's doing what you want to do. Others say it's having the ability to do otherwise. Some people define it in terms of autonomy. Others in terms of self-determination, patient self-determination, right, those kinds of issues. Cicero said it was that. When we look at Cicero's definition of what freedom is, it is very closely linked to justice. It's very closely linked to justice and rule-governed behaviors and law of the land. So it's duty-based, right? It is obedience to some well-formulated law. A friend of mine who actually does quite a bit of Roman history and is not so fond of Roman history, he likes the Athenian and the Jerusalem sides much better, he says, well, it's no wonder that this is what has been adopted by many Western nations, including our own. This is our model in the social political realm, because that notion of justice is so easily mispronounced as just us. Right? Just us. All right? So that's one tradition, and this is one quotation that I want you to mull over. Freedom is obedience to the law. Here's another one. And again, borrowing from last week when Peter Thompson was talking about this, a couple of different ways of putting this. Pax Christi is the way that he put it. It's the way that I am most familiar putting it. And this particular quotation is a little bit longer. It comes from one of my favorite authors, whose name is Ursula Le Guin. Anybody ever hear of her? The library has many of her books. And she is an absolutely fantastic writer. Her, she is from the Pacific Northwest. She spent a lot of time living in Salem, Oregon, where she actually wrote one of her best stories. Anybody know which one I'm talking about? Nope, it's a short story called The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas. The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas. And when you see Omelas, you think, well, what is Omelas? It's Salem O spelled backwards. All right, so very, very highly recommended story. In any case, she follows in this tradition. She had a father who was an anthropologist, and her father took her to all sorts of lands, and she came back to a fundamental kind of belief in something like what comes out of Jerusalem, the Christian tradition. So listen to her, a quotation from her. She says, she's here talking about one of her characters. He had spent his whole life learning how to choose to do what he had no choice but to do. All right, I wanted to put that up there on the board as opposed to just reading through it, because if you can read my writing, it's worth thinking about what exactly she's saying here. So this character
seem the same to me.
They seem the same to you.
Yeah.
Okay. In part, they are. But only in part.
But
yes.
One becomes the identity. It is taken into the identity of the person rather than the collection.
And how do you see that coming out of that plane? That the taking it into your identity, into who you are as you create yourself?
Well, you have to. Well, the fact that you spend the life learning to do this, so that it becomes intrinsic rather than extrinsic.
Right. Okay, exactly right. One more comment.
Well, you can obey Pax Romana and not believe in it.
Right.
Because you're afraid of going to jail or whatever. You're afraid of the consequences.
That's why, if we draw upon what we did a few days ago, Kierkegaard would call Cicero in the Rome tradition a tradition of tragic heroes. Mm-hmm. Right? Think again of Antigone. Think again of those who give themselves over, both of you said this in different ways, who give themselves over to a system, to another, be it ethics, be it an ethical system, be it a scientific system, be it institutionalized religion, as Kierkegaard says. You lose yourself that way. All right? You can follow the rules as good as any kind of robot, right? Because you're programmed. The rules are there, the duties are there, and you act on them. Here, as you point out, it comes in, right? You don't lose yourself in this second claim that Ursula Le Guin makes. He spent his whole life learning, all right? So that draws upon the cogitans, that draws upon the mind, and if he's doing it in his life, obviously he has to do it when he's alive, so that draws upon the body, all right? He's learning how to choose to do what he had no choice but to do, all right? This last part, what he had no choice but to do. Somebody in the Romana tradition will say, determinism, not free. He didn't have a choice to do it. Is that what she's saying? Why not? How does this differ?
Well, there's choose and then there's participation.
Okay, all right. So how to choose to do what he had no choice to do. So you choose what you have no choice to do? Does that sound like Jumbo Shrimp again?
What it sounds like is spend his whole life learning how to do things according to the law. Mm-hmm. But eventually, by learning the law, found out that the law had no bearing because the truth was completely different than the law.
Okay. All right. So what he did is he made that leap, right? He made that leap where, sure, he used his mind. He wrestled with justice and with all of the traditional rule-governed legalistic kinds of things that we wrestle with. But he went beyond that. He took that leap of faith. And when he took that leap of faith, he had to do what came before him. This is that moral sense again. It's where, I think I used the word, you know, it's where you're stunned, where you cannot help do but what you do. I'm sure Martin King Luther Jr. felt that way, right? I mean, he saw the injustice. I'm sure Rosa Parks, what did Rosa Parks do? She was stunned by the situation that she saw. And she could not help do but what she had to do. All right? She knew the laws. She had the mental stuff down, the cognitive stuff down. Right? But she overpassed that. She overcame that. All right? She didn't settle with that.
So essentially it's the example of Abraham and Isaac.
It is the example.
He knew the law. The law says, do not kill your child. But when God asks you to do something, you have to be willing to go that far according to your love of God.
Right. Exactly. And that brings us back to the notion of fire, right, and spirit. Fire in all sorts of ways, but spiritedness. Again, that militant Christianity. And I know we have to use that very, very carefully, but we use that, right, in the sense of this aggressive faith that we ought to have. I mean, if you're stunned, if God were to appear to us right here, right now, right, wouldn't you be stunned? How, and this, again, is unmediated. It's where you can't capture that in language. It's so amazing. It's so wondrous. All right? So here, we do have freedom. Ursula Le Guin's character is not unfree. He's entirely free. Can he explain himself? No way, because he'll fall right back into that tradition. All right? Okay. Yeah.
Professor, a friend of mine was excavating in the Holy Land, and they came upon an old synagogue. And under Pax Romana, you were required to put the Roman eagle above the doorpost of every structure. And that would have violated, of course, their beliefs. And on this synagogue, the eagle was placed upside down.
Wow. Ooh. Wow.
So they followed Pax Romana.
Yeah.
But actually they were more in their heart following Pax Christi.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, it is. All right, so we're going to push a little bit further because we have to have time for my last story. Okay, so we've got two quotations. There's the first one. Here's the second one. Let me give you the third one. All right. The third one is this one. It is an ancient cone that actually comes from somewhere in the Far East. The Japanese have claimed it, but it's actually been around for much, much longer than their particular history. And here is what this cone says. There is no solution. Seek it lovingly. All right, so you wanted solutions and conclusions? Here's a solution and a conclusion. There is no solution. Seek it lovingly. I want to parse this out a little bit. I want to take a look at solution, seeking, and lovingly. All right? If we take a look at the first part, there is no solution, what that tells us is, again, the uncertainty that governs our lives. There is no solution. There is no objective answer. Even in the science, in the sciences, where we have the greatest degree of subjectivity, right? Even there, paradigms are constantly shifting. Even mathematicians, I know there was a mathematician here yesterday, I don't see her today. Even in mathematics, that little identity sign, that's a social construction. There are proofs which will show you that 1 equals 1 is only an approximation. Okay, it's not a solid, absolute, knock-down, drag-out fact. You're a math major. You know about that. He also, as a math major, knows things such as the Gödel's uncertainty theorem. All right. So one of the most famous accomplishments in mathematics in the 1940s shows that you cannot have a complete system that is at the same time consistent. All right? So there is no solution. We live in uncertainty. There is no objective answer. All right? But yet, we ought to seek it lovingly. We ought to seek it lovingly. Seeking is part of our nature. Right? We cannot help but seek. Many of the phenomenologists that I referred to briefly on Wednesday say that, think about a baby. Think about a newborn baby, right? Or even think about a 3 or a 4 or an 8-year-old. All right? If the 8-year-old doesn't play its DVD or what is it called? DS, those are the big things. Right? If they don't play their electronic toys too much. They're amazed by the world. They have a wonder at the world. I don't know how old Michaela is. Michaela now lives in our house with her mother. Michaela's about that tall. She's probably about 4.
She's four,
okay. And I asked her what she thought about the mountains right before we got together today, and she said, awesome. And, you know, it's just, what a word for her to choose. Awesome, right? And said just like that, all right? So by nature, we're curious. We seek. Animals don't seek in the same sort of way. They're programmed like our bodies are programmed, right? If you eat too many Twinkies, we now know what happens, right? So our we're too tired, because we're too stressed, right? Because we lead the wrong kinds of lives. But when we talk about nature there, we also have to talk about these things. Our skills, we all have them. Our gifts, we all have them. And our talents. Our skills, our gifts, and our talents. They all play a role when we seek. So our skills are the stuff we've learned in this tradition, right? The bookish kind of knowledge, right? The knowledge that we learn by reading and reading and reading. But let's do talents next. Talents are part of what I've called our natural lottery. So if some of us are, you know, really, really tall, one of our talents might be that we can play basketball well, all right? If we're really, really short, maybe one of our talents can be that we're great ballet dancers, all right? So our talents vary, and they're given to us by the natural lottery. We can't pre-program those. What about this word? I haven't used that word yet these past 2 weeks. What are those gifts?
The innate spiritual abilities.
Okay. I don't like the word innate because that's bodily stuff, but they're the fire again, right? So how do we get those gifts? How do we account for that? You would never believe that when I was in graduate school, spent a long time in graduate school. I think I spent 5 years in graduate school. While I was in graduate school, all the classes that I took, I spoke up in class once. All right? So that was not a gift of mine. That was not a gift of mine. Of course, I was in a very different context then. But then somehow I found a voice. Where did that voice come from? You know, my mother to this day always knew me as a very, very quiet person. And when I was told her I was coming here to teach, she said, "Do you really think you can do that?" Little did she know. So where does that come from? I have no idea. And I find if I think about it too much, I lose it. Right? If I think about it too much, I lose it. Just like many people who are in sports. I once had the opportunity to meet Pete Sampras when he was still playing very actively his tennis games and tennis matches. And we talked, you know, at that point I was very much into philosophy in a sort of narrow sort of way, in my philosophy of mind sort of way. And so I asked him, well, what is it like, you know, to be up against somebody like Agassi and, you know, to be in a very tight match? And his claim was, I don't think about it. Because as soon as I think about where my hand is or how my hand is holding on to that racket or the speed at which I have to hit the ball to get Agassi not to be able to return it, I lose the game. All right? So where does that come from? Language obviously messes up those gifts. All right? It's not going to mess up this, and it might not mess up that, but it's going to get in the way of the gifts. All right? You just let them flow, if Sampras is right about this. Being in the zone is all about this. If you think about what you're doing, it's gone. So what is that? What is that? All right, lovingly. Here, I think the word we need to use is passion. All right, it is passion. So there is no solution. Seek it lovingly. Seek it with passion. Seek it with care. Right? Seek it carefully, because it's fragile. Seek it, I think, as well, if we go back to our fire, seek it with a spiritedness. We don't use that word enough, I think, the notion of spiritedness. All right? And I think that's part of what passion is. I think it's what that aggressive faith is. So there isn't any solution. Certainly there isn't any solution if you're in the Pax Romana, because there it's all illusion. There it's that mask of inauthenticity that I've talked about. All right? But nevertheless, seek it lovingly, because it is there. All right? Same kind of idea as the quotation I used a while back about arrange for me a splendid insecurity. Arrange for me a splendid insecurity. We don't want insecurity in our lives. Again, John was great at describing a lot of this. Right? We want to have perfectly programmed lives. How do we feel if we lose our cell phone, for example. You know, we feel crazy. We go crazy, and if we lose our contact with the internet, we go even crazier, right? Well, gee whiz. Maybe there's something good about doing that, right? Arrange for me a splendid insecurity. All right, that's the same as that, I think. It comes down to the same point. All right, I've got about 10 minutes left. Comments, questions, answers. And then I have a story.
We're waiting for the story.
You're waiting for the story? Okay, you're waiting for the story. Ah,
just
patience.
To say that as we were, pastoral care professor talked about that one of the huge transitions in counseling was that they went from the problem-solving model to the problem-management model.
Mm-hmm.
That your problems cannot be solved, they can only be managed.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And how that was just kind of a helpful breakthrough.
Yeah.
That allowed that, you know, rather than throwing a pill at it or a magic solution, you know, you had to kind of create relationships and maintain community that helped you manage whatever issue you had, but it stopped, you know, assuming that there was a solution out there to be grabbed.
Yeah.
But it said, no, you just got to manage it.
Right.
And how that is even helpful for the person suffering.
Right.
And that was actually a big breakthrough to be able to say that.
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to mention when we were talking still about quality of life as one of the kinds of things we need to think about, guha aside for a moment, is the idea again in John's Affluenza, where he says we have to focus on the family again, right? I mean, it's such a simple thing. But if you look at the statistics, you know, 40 minutes a day, or 40 minutes a week with our children, yet 6 hours a week with the television, you know, we're not managing the family scene very well. And I thought there's an even more holistic way of putting that point, and that is we're not communicating well. With each other, we don't communicate well. You know, when we really listen, perfect example, I spent much of my childhood in Europe and sort of grew up with some of the European traditions even when I was here. And I remember I was about 8 years old, and I noticed, you know, the thing to do was always to say, how are you? You see somebody that you know well or not so well, and you say, so how's it going? How are you? And I was asked that question as an 8-year-old by a very well-meaning acquaintance, and I thought they really wanted to know how I was. So I told them this elaborate story. They kept looking at their clock, and, you know, they didn't want to be rude. But I was 8, and I still remember that, right? So the next time you say, so how are you? You know, think about how effective that is as communication. Or if you might just want to say, hi, which would be far more honest, right? Another example, one more example of the same kind of point, you know, the idea of, instead of just throwing a pill or a DS player or a new toy at our children or each other, right, talk to them. Again, it's that simplicity, frugality even. It's that simplicity idea. Great example. This, I was in February of this year. I do clinical ethics, as some of you know, and there was a case that we did, and there was it was a family that was of Hispanic origin, a very traditional family, and the mother of this family, who was sort of the cornerstone of the family, had some very serious heart issues, and it looked like she was going to need a very serious bypass surgery. And so the cardiologist was explaining this to the mother with her family, her entire family there assembled. And they had somewhat broken English, but they thought that the English was good enough so that they could explain the situation. So the heart surgeon who was going through this spent a good half hour, maybe even 40 minutes, talking about, you know, the pros, the cons, risks, benefits. And then he said at the end, so do you understand? Do you understand what we're going to do? And the woman very cheerfully piped up right away, yes, yes, I understand. You're saying that my heart is square. And the surgeon looked at her and looked at this little piece of paper that he had been using to explain her situation. And sure enough, he had talked about valves in parts of the heart and drawn the heart as square. So 40 minutes later, who's about to have this surgery walks out with the perfect understanding that her heart is problematic because it's square. Not such good communication, right? Not such good communication, and about a very, very important issue. All right, so I take your point very, very well, and I take it to heart. Okay, so my story. My story comes, let's see, we'll leave this up here. And my story is about my mother. All right, I have never really told this story to a group of this size, but I'll tell you this story because I think that it demonstrates something pretty darn amazing, probably something that I would never do. So my parents, my family is from Germany. My parents went through as very young young people the Second World War. And they actually got married during the war, my father and mother. And my father got drafted, forced to join the army, which, you know, if he didn't do it, he would have, at that time, probably he would have either ended up in jail for a very long time in very bad circumstances, or he would have been killed. All right, so it was later on in the war when things were pretty desperate. So that's my father. They had just been married. It turns out I have a brother who was born a year after they were married, again, right in the middle of the last part of the war. And my father was, he was fortunate, might be a miracle, but he was fighting a group of British soldiers, and his unit was fighting their unit repeatedly. And for some odd reason, again, who knows what that reason is, in the evening, these soldiers, which were very closely, in close quarters, they would get together, they'd put down their arms, they'd get together, and they would play cards. Okay, the British soldiers, some of the British soldiers, and some of the German soldiers, of which my father was one. All right, so they'd get together night after night, play cards, have a great time, drink scotch, as I'm told, and then in the morning, they would go back to fighting each other. Okay, this happened for several weeks. All right, bizarre, bizarre. So my father got to know some of these British soldiers very, very well, and was captured by them, became a prisoner of war by the British soldiers. They shipped my father off to Egypt, where they had their big prisoner of war camp. All right, my father spent the rest of the war there, which was a great thing because otherwise he would have been sent on to the Russian front, where the rest of his group went, and they all perished there. All right, so my father's a prisoner of war in a British camp in Egypt. My father had great facility with language. He was gifted. He could pick up languages like that, so he spoke English very well. All right, so they offered him a job. So when the war ended, my father had a job as a translator for the British Army in Berlin. All right, so what about my mother? Right, my mother is back at home now with a 2.5-year-old. All right, she's living with her parents. And she doesn't know where my father is, because once he was in the prisoner of war camp, they lost communication, they lost contact, as happens in wars. All right? So she's there with my brother. My father is in Berlin. They don't know that of each other. So obviously they found each other because I'm here, right? So what happens is, through the grapevine, my mother hears that my father is somewhere in Berlin. We don't have any relatives in Berlin, but, you know, word trickled down. Not necessarily reliable, but word trickled down. It gave her hope. All right? So another year or so passed, and another year or so passed, and the part of Germany where my family comes from was given to Russia. So it became East Germany. And as soon as it became East Germany, a wall was built. All right. Now, it wasn't the brick wall that you see in Berlin, but it was a barbed wire fence, all right, with all sorts of nasty, sharp things at top, and lots of landmines scattered randomly, and heavily, heavily armed soldiers, every, half mile or so. So if you were one of these East Germans, and there were thousands of them, who tried to escape, your chances were slimmer than slim because you were shot on spot. As a matter of fact, when I was young, starting from about age 5, we actually would go back to East Germany and visit my grandparents, my aunts, and my uncles, and my cousins, all right? And I remember seeing those landmines and those soldiers and going through those security checks and having to actually check in every week with the local government to prove that I was still there and, oh, by the way, pay them a handsome fee for the privilege of visiting their country. All right? So the wall went up. My mother had wasted too much time. All right? How was she going to get to Berlin where my father maybe was? So she did the incredible thing. She took my brother, who was at that point now 3, and there was a guy in the area who said, well, you know, if anybody ever wants to sneak through that wall, I can do it. You gotta pay me a lot of money, but I will do it. All right? Now, they lost everything. My mother's family lost all that they had when their part of Germany was given to the Soviet Union, to Russia. They lost everything because it all became public. So the house that they lived in was a two-story house. They divided the house up into quarters, and 3 new families moved into their house that they had lived in for many, many, many years. Right? So everything went public. They didn't have much money. But they scraped together enough money to give to my mother so she could trust this maybe uncanny character to take her through a gap in the wall that he claimed to know with my brother and get to the other side. She did it. She did it. It involved climbing over the Erzgebirge, which is a mountain range sort of like this mountain range right out here, Martin Ridge. She did it as soon as it turned dark with the guide and with my brother in tow, right? He was 3, so he couldn't walk. They did it at night because they couldn't be seen. They went over the mountain, barely made it in time because my brother was so darn slow and she had to carry him and it was a real hassle. Got to the barbed wire fence. There were no landmines. The guide was genuine. There was a cut in the fence. A cut, you know, the fence just had a very slim cut. They pulled that apart. She and my brother went through just as the sun was rising and the guide disappeared. Never heard of him again. So now she was in the West. Now she was in West Germany. She didn't have any money. And she turned out to be fairly far down in West Germany, so that it was a long trip by train to get up to Berlin, about 5 hours, actually, at that time. So she begged for money. Okay, she didn't explain what was going on because she couldn't trust anybody that close to the wall. She begged for money. She got the money, probably because my brother was cute, but she got the money, all right, made it to Berlin, went to the place where they said my father might be working, which happened to be the British Embassy, said with very, very bad English, she didn't have his capacity in language, you know, is there a Gerhard Storl who works here? And they said, oh, yes, 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 let me take you to him. And they've been together ever since. He passed away, actually, about 3 years ago. But they were together ever since. So I asked myself, as I was walking the other day up on Martin Ridge, that's what brought that story to mind. You know, could I have done that? Think of what that took. Think of uncertainty. Man, there was a lot of uncertainty there. And she risked my brother's life. Right? She risked my brother's life. 3 years old. He could have grown up as a young pioneer in East Germany. No problem there. Right? No problem there. They were willing to take anyone. They were willing to take me for my short visits, right? So he could have done that. He could have managed, but no, no. It was because of love that she took those risks, and it was because of faith that she thought that they could actually see her to the point where they would be reunited. And talk about skills, gifts, and talents, they were abundant, right? But what a story. So that's the story I wanted to share with you, and that's also, you know, the reason I wanted to share that particular story is because I wonder, you know, if I could do that. If I could take my son or my daughter and hike at night across something as strenuous as that with someone I didn't know, right, a guy I didn't know, who I had paid lots of money to. Oh, and by the way, once I reached the other side, of course, I would never see my family again. So I don't know if I'm going to see my husband. I have my child. And I'm never going to see my parents again. All right. Now, as it turned out, she was able to see her parents again, but that's another story.